We have approximately a little bit over an hour this morning, and we'll use as much or as little of that as we have to. I don't think it's very necessary for me to reintroduce Bert. Some of you have heard him already yesterday. For those of you who have not, this is Burton Black, who's the Dean of College of Education at Syracuse University, and he's here for yesterday and today as an Ida Beam Scholar. And we've been happy and pleased to have him and enjoyed listening to him. So, Bert.
Well, thank you again, friends. Some of you have been following me around for the past 2 days, and I did advise Paul that possibly you are entitled to one credit in mental retardation if you pass today's final examination. As the great American philosopher Mae West once remarked, I always try to resist temptation unless I find it irresistible. And who could resist one more hour to make this point that I've been trying to make for the past 2 days now? And that is that in the final analysis, people are people, and we all have a similar beginning, and we all have exactly the same ending. And during the time between, we should find better ways to not only get along together, but to help each other, which is not easy, especially these days. Today I want to talk about normalization and desegregation and deinstitutionalization and the future society. I remember a number of years ago I chaired a panel appointed by some very high muckamuck national committee. And the panel members came from many, many environments, states, contexts. And as a result, I, and I thought the others, tried very hard to keep at a minimum the idiosyncratic language that professionals especially like to use, the highfalutin language that professors not only like to, but most always use. So I was somewhat surprised when, after the first session, that very nice lady from Alabama stopped me and she said, "You know, I wish you would not use that difficult language that I find very hard to comprehend and to accept." And I just didn't know what she was getting at. So I said, "Well, could you please give me an example of this difficult language?" She said, "Well, you know, some of the words you use are very difficult for me to take and understand." I said, "Well, what word in particular are you getting at?" And she said, "Segregation." Well, normalization is one of those words. There's hardly a week that passes that I do not get a report from a State Department or an institution that informs me how they are normalizing their clients. Now, I got something just the other day, which you will be interested in. A state institution in New York State, as a matter of fact, a pretty good one from those I've visited, and I'd say this is one which I am least worried about. I'm worried about it, but least worried about it. And they have a new policy. They attach to those clients who leave without authorization, and when one leaves without authorization in New York State institutions, they use the term elopement. They elope. Believe it or not, that is the official term. That is, if you get up from your dormitory and you walk out for a day or so, or you go downtown and don't come back, you've eloped. And if they don't want you in the institution in the first place, they refuse to take you back. They say, you've eloped, and now you can't come back. Well, those who they have to take back, for one reason or another, and they worry about, because these are people with severe problems of one kind or another, and they're worried they're going to hurt themselves, possibly even others. They now have a new policy where they attach to the individual's garment one of those bugging devices, a beeper. So when he elopes, that thing starts buzzing around and they track it and they go pick him up. Well, a couple of us complained about that. That seemed like it might be some sort of an infringement on somebody's human, if not exactly legal rights. And I was told that the reason they have this bugging device, and I was shown the memo which justifies it, is because it is normalizing. That is, it is much more normalizing to attach the bugging device on the individual than to seclude him or to restrain him or to enchain him. That when there's a choice between locking somebody up to prevent him from eloping or bugging him to retrieve him if he starts to elope, obviously it's much more normalizing to bug him. What's the issue on normalization, on that concept that virtually everyone uses and possibly few understand well? The issue is freedom. No one is normalized unless he or she is free. No one is free unless he or she is normalized. People give up their lives to be free. And that's one of the few things people give up their lives for. They don't give up their lives for another grade or two in reading or arithmetic. They don't even give up their lives to get a university degree. But they do give up their lives to be free. And so, one of the questions we will try to address today, who deserves to be free, as one of the questions we addressed yesterday afternoon at the developmental disabilities discussion, who deserves to live? I'm not going to give you a official definition of normalization. That couldn't tempt me. There are so many written, and they're all official, and you've read most of them, that I thought maybe I would give you my idiosyncratic sense of what it means and try to explain what I mean by my idiosyncratic language. Normalization is not hiding differences, but capitalizing on differences. For example, some of you are acquainted with the work of Jean Vanier, who created the L'Arche movement, communities for people with disabilities as well as people like you and I. And these homes are everywhere in the world, including Syracuse. And when one visits a L'Arche environment, you get the sense that living together, the handicapped and the non-handicapped, is not a duty of the non-handicapped, as it is for many non-handicapped who run group homes, And as it probably is for most non-handicapped who run institutions, but it's a joy. It's an opportunity. That it's not a burden to live with handicapped people. It's not a job, although one lives there and derives an income. It's not a responsibility, although there are many responsibilities. But it's a conscious choice because this is where one wants to live. And these are the people with whom one wants to live. We could look at it another way. If a man or woman or whomever it is that comes from Mars could come here, and if they had a bag with some magic dust that could be dropped over the earth, and if that magic dust cured all of mental retardation everywhere on earth, you could conceptualize that. So there is no longer mental retardation on earth. For sure, all those who are in institutions for the retarded would leave. Nobody would want to live there. Not the residents, and I dare say, not even the workers. They'd leave. However, in the Losh home, or in the Camp Hill community, they'd stay. This is their home. In the same way you'd stay in your home. In the same way you'd stay in your home with your retarded child who's living in your home, who is no longer retarded. The no longer retarded child wouldn't leave the home. Still has a mother and father. Still has the school and the community. Now, though, he's going to be in a new class. And he's going to be reading the New York Times at night. Or the Des Moines Register. There's no accounting for taste. So you see what I'm saying. There are homes and there are homes. And this idea of home-like. I don't like that term. I get that in the mail every week. We run a home-like institution. Or a home-like group home. Or a home-like ICFMR. Well, either they are homes or they are not homes. My home is not home-like, it's a home. In fact, anything that has hyphen like after it, you know, is not really like what it's supposed to be hyphenated to. Eh? Now, it's like genuine antique reproductions. If you want a contradiction in terms or a non sequitur. I mean, if it's a reproduction, it's not a genuine antique. And if it's home-like, it's not a home. So we have to get a little straighter in our language. If we're going to have a home, then we can't say that the ICFMR for 20 or 30 or 10 or 15 residents is a home. It's an intermediate care facility. Maybe much better than an institution. It might even be a lot better than some homes. You and I know there are some terrible homes. But because the ICFMR is better than some homes, that doesn't mean it is a home. Let me put it still another way. Nobody in our culture, or few anyway, or very few, that are seriously listened to is suggesting that because divorce is rampant in America and marriages in so many instances are very fragile and that there have always been bad marriages even during those days when divorce wasn't rampant, no one seriously is suggesting that we do away with marriage and family. They're saying, well, let's try and strengthen families and let's try to strengthen the society so there will be fewer divorces. But because there are problems with families and problems with marriages, we're not rushing to do away with the idea of marriage and family. And so this invidious comparison of rotten homes to good institutions make absolutely no sense to me. Of course there are rotten homes. Of course there are people in institutions who live far better than other people who live in their own homes. It's not a justification for institutions. It might be a justification to do something about rotten homes. Well, you know the people who have articulated the concept of normalization, Wolfensberger and my own institution, Syracuse University, Beck Neary and Bont Nicholson and Carl Grunewald and Gunnar Dibwad. You've seen or read about some of the models of normalization that have been articulated, Nebraska NCORE, and Daly. We see or read about great normalized communities for the handicapped and others who had been previously incarcerated or segregated. Normalization is being part of the ordinary world, as Neary says, taking part in the ordinary rhythms and activities of daily living. Well, let's for a few minutes look at the news and then I'll get at my actual talk. This is sort of warm up. I want to talk about the language a little bit more, the terminology we use. A few months ago, the good citizens of Berkeley, California had on the ballot a referendum question, a very serious question. Should mental patients receive electric shock therapy? And that was put to the vote. Very curious question for referendum. A medical question put to the people, is it good or bad? It's like putting on the ballot, should people with infections take penicillin or not? Or should pregnant women have obstetricians or practical nurses deliver the baby? Or is aspirin better than X drug or Y drug? Or should we have open heart surgery for people who have closed vessels? You think that's a question that medical practitioners ought to decide, not the citizens? Well, in our business, whether it's put to the citizens or to the professionals themselves, it's usually by such votes. And there's a reason for it. A few years ago, the American Psychiatric Association put for vote before its board of delegates the question whether homosexuality is a mental disease or a different sexual orientation. Now, you'd think that too is a question that isn't answerable by a vote. Raise your right hand if you think homosexuality is a mental disease. Raise your left hand if you think it's merely a different sexual orientation. Well, the left hand's won. And so the new nomenclature manual of the American Psychiatric Association now says that it is no longer a mental disease.
So,
any of you who are of that persuasion, you know you've been cured by vote. You are no longer mentally diseased. You merely have a different sexual orientation. It's a funny way to wipe out a disease. I wish we could wipe out cancer that way. Or the common cold. 100 years ago, masturbation was viewed as a mental disease. And people who were found engaging in that loathsome practice were put in mental hospitals. Well documented in the literature. Today, what was once the disease, as defined by psychiatrists, is now the cure. People go to psychiatrists and are advised, you should engage in that practice, it reduces your tensions. Well, how could you have a scientific field where what was once the disease is now considered the treatment? In my own field of mental retardation, in 1957, the nomenclature manual of the American Association on Mental Deficiency, the official keepers of the definition, and therefore the group with the biggest club, because they who own the language own the field, own the ideology. You own the language, you own the field. Right now, the deinstitutionalizers and normalizers seem to be owning the language, so everyone is for deinstitution and normalization. Well, AAMD in 1957 declared for the world to understand that mental retardation is a constitutional condition of the central nervous system, exists from birth to early age, is incurable and irremediable. Which means that something in the head, something real in the head, some damage of some sort or some weakness, it's constitutional. It's incurable, it's irremediable, can't be cured, can't be remedied. It always requires that the individual have some sort of supervision during the school years and some sort of special program if he's capable enough to go to a special school or program. And after he or she leaves school, must be under continuous supervision. That was the definition. Well, in 1959, the American Association on Mental Deficiency, after many years of the definition previously summarized for you, said, no, we're not going to define it that way anymore. Because, for one thing, our neurologists and psychologists and other medical and psychological and educational specialists inform us that there are many people defined as mentally retarded who don't seem to have a constitutional condition of the central nervous system, what you used to call cultural familial mentally retarded. And we can't seem to find them at birth or early age, a la the Sam Kirk's early education study, my early education study, and lots of others. And after these people leave school, they become indistinguishable in the community. So it doesn't seem to be lifelong. And so all we could say about it is that mental retardation is subaverage general intellectual functioning. If you behave now like you're retarded, you're retarded. Subaverage functioning, which exists with an adaptive disorder, a disorder of maturation, learning, or social adjustment. And they further define subaverage functioning as IQ on some standardized instruments, more than one standard deviation away from the mean. That is, IQ less than 85. That is, an IQ which approximately 16% of the ordinary population have, less than 85 IQ. That was the definitional change. It was a profound change, because until 1959, we couldn't cure mental retardation. It was impossible by definition. Because anybody who changed from a state of mental retardation to a state of normality couldn't have been retarded, because it was an incurable, irremediable condition. So anybody who changed was, by definition, not retarded. Might have been what we used to call pseudo-retarded. We made a mistake. So there's never been a documented instance of cure. That's why We've always said that mental retardation is incurable, but the mentally ill, well, they can change, they can be cured, because by definition they could be cured. Well, with the new definition, somebody could change. Somebody has an 85 IQ this year, 10 years later, doesn't have an 85 IQ, or has an 85 IQ that's not associated with an adaptive disorder. Of course, you need both low IQ and adaptive disorder to be mentally retarded, so people can change. People can be, in that sense, cured. Well, we fumbled along with that definition from 1959 to about 1974. There was a big argument in the field throughout those years. Well, what was the argument about? Well, do we really want to include under this umbrella mental retardation people with 85 IQs? People who are so marginally different? The educators said, of course. New clientele. Some others said, no. So they changed the definition ever so slightly. And the new committee, now chaired by Herbert Grossman, former committee in 59, was chaired by Rick Heber. New committee changed that definition ever so slightly in 1974, and they said, yes, mental retardation is subaverage general intellectual functioning associated with an adaptive disorder, but it really is significant subaverage general intellectual functioning, which was also defined as two standard deviations away from the mean, now constituting IQs less than 70, not 85, and now containing not 16% of the population, but 2% of the population. And so, with one fell swoop of Herbert Grossman's pen or pencil, in some smoke-filled room, a committee, some of whom probably hadn't dosed or examined a retarded child or any other child in years and years, if ever, that committee cured more mental retardation than all of the scientists, scholars, and clinicians since the beginning of time, because they changed the incidence, the theoretical incidence of psychometric retardation to include from 16% of the population to 2% of the population. So I ask you, what's mental retardation?
By the way, Bert, in this state, we haven't done that. We still have the criteria of only having one standard deviation.
85 IQ.
Yeah, we needed more kids in class.
You needed more kids. Well, that's all right. As I said before, there's no accounting for taste. Now, the gobbledygook in the field, is pervasive. And it's perpetrated by professionals, usually of the highest stature, and inflicted on university students, as well as parents and lay citizens. For example, this is a quote from the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Chicago, Daniel X. Friedman, who said these memorable words at his presidential address of the American Psychiatric Association in May of 1982. His presidential address. And of course it took my good friend Thomas Zoss, who is also somewhat of an iconoclastic psychiatrist, whose office is right across the street from mine, and who shares with me many of our convictions that the fields of psychiatry, special education, and psychology could probably stand some reform. The good doctor, distinguished president of the American Psychiatric Association, says this, quote, "Recall that clinical experience and science do incrementally define the selective use of innovations, while policy reflexly greets innovation with prophecies of fiscal doom. In retrospect, the actual gains for health might render such poor profits a loss. Profits with a P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S. But maybe he had something else on his mind. Where policy seeks formulas for determining choice and guiding treatment, science understands the fundamental basis for variability in disease and response and the method for sequentially approximating precision in the clinical process. What in blazes is he talking about? What does that mean? I keep looking at that paragraph and I can't for the life of me understand one thing he's saying here. We go to our own journals in the field of mental retardation. For the most part, they are unreadable. They are incomprehensible. This field does not suffer from an abundance of plain language. And what I'm about to tell you might sound unbelievable to you, but I can assure you that after my visit to this community, it was verified by visits to these schools and speaking to the parents of some of these children concerned. And everything that's said here is not only done, it's perfectly legal in the state of Kentucky, and maybe elsewhere. 60%, I'm quoting from her letter to me, which I verified, of moderately retarded girls in this particular school district receive hysterectomies between the ages of 10 and 13 for menstrual hygiene reasons. I have checked with the PNA and Civil Liberties Union, and in absence of a Kentucky statute on sterilization, this is legal as long as their parents give informed consent, which they do. They are told it's important for you to sterilize your 10-year-old daughter because she's mentally retarded, and for menstrual hygiene reasons, that's very important. In addition, large populations of teenage and adult retarded women are receiving monthly injections of Depo-Provera, which I've learned presents some very serious health risks to some people who take this drug. Now, you've heard about deinstitutionalization. You've heard about the cries going up from some of the local citizens that the mental hospitals are dumping people in the community. But as a matter of fact, in the last newspaper of this month in mental health in New York, which is one of the official voice of the mental health department, the bragging paper, they said in their own paper, hospitalization of mentally ill residents have risen 2,000 each of the last 2 years. So there's no longer a deinstitutionalization in New York State in mental health, but a return back to the institutions. And as budgets get lower, you'll see it in mental retardation, and it'll continue and continue. And if we don't stop what's going on across the country, it's not going to be too many years before we're going to have warehouses and Christmas in purgatory. I'm on the board of visitors of our local state institution for the retarded, a good one, I think, as these places go. But even good state schools for the retarded engage in insane practices. This is just one little item. First, I must tell you about incident reports. Maybe in your state schools you have the same thing, but if somebody has a fingernail torn, one of the attendants has to write out a report. If somebody stubs a toe, you write a report. If somebody falls out of a fourth-story window and gets killed, you write a report. So there was an incident report written for anyone who has an accident, an abuse, an assault, serious or not serious. Here was an incident report. Miss so-and-so, a resident, had been in the living room. I was supervising the area and assisting clients with their hair. Then I heard some, I'm not going to read it, it'll take too long. Then I heard some noise. So I went into a bedroom. I now have bedrooms for two and three people. And there I saw Miss Boyd and Mr. So-and-so fornicating. So what did the attendant say? These are two severely retarded residents. I suggested that they dress and come out for snacks. Which they did. Now, this incident was reported at an incident meeting that the boards of visitors take turns attending. What surprised, two things surprised me, of course, the attendant's reaction to this, I think, unusual incident and her unusual reaction. But what even surprised me more is the people around the table never questioned this. They didn't even laugh the way you laugh. I mean, it does seem something that even Woody Allen couldn't construct for one of his lunatic movies. Walking in on two people doing that sort of thing and saying, look, let's stop. Let's have milk and cookies. And they get dressed and come out and have their milk and cookies. And that was the end of it. And any place that has these kinds of things go on very regularly, if not this particular incident, all kinds of unexplainable things, to call this a normalized environment, it's stretching. I've been accused once in a while of being too critical of my brethren. I wrote this book recently, The Family Papers, and I suggested in the book with my two young co-authors that there is a family in mental retardation. And we all know what's going on. We know many of the very serious, very bad things that are going on, but we sort of keep it all to ourselves. We are a family, and we do not expose our dirty linen outside of the family. In fact, live and let live seems to be the philosophy among the professionals in the field of mental retardation. And I'm asked, why are you such a critic? Why are you so critical? Let me tell you a story. The great Nobel laureate Isaac Bashevis Singer writes these Yiddish stories about people in the ghettos of Poland. And every now and then he writes or tells about his grandfather, the rabbi of Bilgori. Now once his grandfather was surrounded by some of the flock, and one asked him, Rabbi, why is it if God is so omnipotent, and you keep teaching us that God is all powerful, and God is omnipotent, and God could do whatever he wants, why is it if God is so omnipotent, there's a devil? You'd think that with the omnipotence of God, he would find a way to get rid of the devil. And the rabbi thought for a moment, he said, well, there's a very good reason for that. You see, God created the devil. So they said, why would God want to create the devil? Because God, too, needs critics. And if God needs critics, our field needs critics. And there aren't enough of them. We're so satisfied. We're so smug. We've got it all knocked up. And we don't. And every time one of us gets in deep water, ourselves, or someone from our family, and we seek the assistance of this large, powerful, professional network of experts, we then truly realize how difficult it is to get good service, to get real help. It's very hard. So, what are the issues on normalization, mainstreaming, and deinstitutionalization in this future society? I think there's an argument between those who believe that children with special needs, or all people, should live in ordinary communities and attend ordinary schools in ordinary classes, and others who contend that children or others with special needs are best served by specialized programs supervised by specially trained teachers who employ special methods and use unique facilities and equipment. Stated another way, it's a debate between those who believe that freedom is a more precious right for the individual than treatment, as contrasted with those who'd be willing to sacrifice some freedom or physical integration in order to foster educational benefits. I'll give you my personal view and also my personal belief where the whole deinstitutionalization movement went wrong and the mainstreaming movement is going wrong. I believe that the issue was fundamentally, should have been fundamentally, is today fundamentally a freedom issue, not a clinical issue. And the analogy that most quickly comes to mind is the one when we consider the question, why did Abraham Lincoln free the slaves? Was it because he was convinced by his then secretary or commissioner or advisor on education that if you freed the slaves, the children of the slaves would now go to school and learn more? Or did his economic advisors inform him that freeing the slaves, you're now going to have a more vibrant economic potential for America? You're going to have people out there who are going to work harder and earn money and buck up the economy, and we're going to hold down the inflation. It's going to make America economically stronger. Or did the Norman Vincent Peale of the time convince Lincoln that if you freed the slaves, they'd be happier? Now, of course, it's good to be happier. It's good to be economically independent. And it's better if the children can read than if they can't read. But none of those were the reasons why Lincoln freed the slaves. Lincoln freed the slaves because he finally became convinced, and it took some time to convince him, that everybody in the United States who wasn't a danger to himself or other people was entitled to live free. He freed the slaves because he believed that they were entitled to be free. And that's why we've been trying to deinstitutionalize the mentally retarded. And that's why we've been attempting to integrate them in the regular schools. If they learn more, wonderful. If they're happier, terrific. But the fundamental reason is the freedom. Look, let's face it. Those of you who are professors here, who are informed by your dean or vice president that henceforth you must spend 10 hours a day in the library, 5 days a week. You're allowed to teach your classes. You're allowed to, you must see your advisees. But every day 10 hours a day. You either must be in the library or you must have special permission. You could be in a laboratory or out in the schools doing research. I can assure you that you write more books, you learn more, you'll be, as they say in the academy, more productive. What would you think of such a proposition from your dean? You say, you can't make me do that. I'll spend as much time in the library as I want to. And I'm sure if those of you who drink were required to give up drinking, or those of you who smoke were required to give up smoking, or those of you who eat too much were required not to eat so much, or the carousers would have to stop carousing, you see? The hedonists would have to stop leading that hellish life. You'd live longer, you'd be more productive, you'd get to work on time, you wouldn't be edging to get out of here at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to get sloshed for the weekend. Everybody would be more productive. Why aren't you doing it? You want to live your own life the way you want to live your own life, as long as you don't break the law, get caught breaking the law, you don't infringe too much on other people. Nobody can tell you not to drink and not to smoke and not to carouse. Of course, your husband or wife could, but some of you don't listen to them. And you'll do as you damn please. No, it's good for you, it's good for them. Why is it that only the retarded and the poor and the other disadvantaged are required to do things that's good for them, and we're not? You see what I'm saying? Yeah, I think we could put you in a university institution and say, don't, you can't go home anymore. We're going to have dormitories for you. Get up in the morning, go to the library, teach your classes, eh? Go back to the dorm. Once you get out of here, you're going to do all kinds of things that we don't approve of. Like have a good time. And you could get drunk. You could rack your car up against a tree. We don't want you to drive. Why don't we impose that on you? Well, that's totalitarian government. You can't do that to me. I'm free. I want to be free. Exactly. Exactly the point. You want to be free. So do they. Even when they screw up, as some of you screw up, okay? You screw up a little bit, you'll try to do better next time. That's what you have confession for. Nobody screwed up, there wouldn't be any need for confession. You're all screwing up. So do they. Doesn't mean we have to institutionalize you, and it shouldn't mean we have to institutionalize them. The issue is freedom. There's no compelling research to support the academic efficacy of either the special class or being in the regular class. I can get into the host of so-called efficacy studies. Mine really being the first one of the post-World War II period in 1956, and there were a whole slew of them. Of course, nobody could believe what I found. 56, so there was Goldstein, et al., and Dunn and Hoddle, and Kane and Levine, both of those with the trainable, Cassidy and Stanton, and Mullen and Itkin, and Johnson, and a whole flock of them. And literally nobody found anything of any consequence. Even Herb Goldstein, who on a secondary analysis found that blighter, mildly retarded people probably did as well in the regular class, and not so bright, mildly retarded people might have done better in the special class. Essentially, nobody found anything. There's no evidence. But even if there were, the issue is freedom. The best, most that could be said is some kids seem to do academically better in the special class and others in the regular class. And that's the end of it. And there's no single problem, no single debate. A lot of polemics. Values. How do you want your society to be constructed. What do you want from your society? What do you want for your children? What do you want for your grandchildren? Do you want a society that incarcerates all of the elderly, which we're fast moving to? I saw a report a few weeks ago, extrapolated that by the year 2000, the country would be spending $200 billion on care of the elderly. Well, the country isn't going to spend $200 billion on care of the elderly. They might spend $200 billion on MX missiles, but certainly not on care of the elderly. And so there's got to be some sort of a policy decision. Either the country is going to kill the elderly, or they're going to have to change their policies of where they can live. Now, before the turn of the century, before World War II, before all we learned about hypertension, blood pressures, and adult learning and strokes, before we got so smart about the elderly lived in ordinary communities. See, the more we know about the elderly, the more we feel we have to incarcerate them. So it isn't just going to the scientists and say, teach us more about the elderly or the retarded, and maybe we'll be able to integrate them more. It's nothing to do with that. We know more about the elderly today than we knew 50 years ago. And 50 years ago, the only old people who ever went to those institutions were poor people without families. It was a great disgrace to put your mother or father in the institution. Now? Watch out. Because if the scene is played out, most of you will probably be in Camelot or Sun Valley. See what I mean? See, this is a condition that you get if you're very lucky. Everybody who's very lucky gets the disease being old. And the way we're going, they're preparing all of those wonderful places for you. So you shouldn't be too sanguine about those things. I mean, you may want to sit here being sanguine about institutionalizing the retarded if you don't have a retarded child, but you might have a retarded grandchild or great-grandchild someday. But incarcerating the elderly, they're going to do it to you if you don't change the policies. I know it's hard for some of you, you're so young to think about that. But someday when you're 93, you're going to remember this talk. You say, I should have listened to him. So there are very, very competing values. The cost of society. Segregation is always more expensive than integration. Anybody who believes differently just wants to believe lies. In New York State right now, we have institutionalized people in state institutions where the per capita expenditure is over $100,000 a year. That's Willowbrook. And children are still going to sleep at night without proper food and pajamas and proper care at a cost of $100,000 a year. I once proposed to a group of administrators at an institution that was expending about $70,000 a year per resident. Why not, and most of these mildly and moderately retarded. I says, why not give at least some of those families, not the $70,000, $25,000, and have an auditor come in and audit how you spend the money. You send the child to camp, you put better food on the table, you got a high-toned pediatrician for your child, you don't have to go to the clinic. Why not do that? You know, it was like I started World War III with that suggestion. The nicest thing they said to me in response was somebody who remarked that I probably was a communist. There's something un-American, you see, un-American about putting supports with the family. Even if it's cheaper and better, there's something ingrained in us which says now the family has to take care of its own. But the state, which traditionally screws up, and I'm not blaming the state, the bureaucrats in any state are no worse or better than professors, but there's something constitutional about activity within a state bureaucracy where if you want something to be screwed up, ask the state to do it in terms of delivering services. The state is very good at collecting resources and redistributing resources and monitoring things, you see, and nailing people who are malfeasant or misfeasant or nonfeasant, you know, those terms. But the state doesn't know how to deliver services. Families are much better in delivering services than the state. That doesn't mean the state is bad. It doesn't mean the bureaucrats are bad. Some of them are heroic. Some of the institutional workers are heroic. While we're sitting here talking, there are people in the institutions who are saints, helping people, putting on their clothes, trying to do something in a system that essentially is unworkable. In a closed facility, in a closed environment, you cannot have the guarantee that there will not be abuse or stupidity. The mood of the nation is bad. The mood of the nation is to reduce services to the disabled, to the old, to the fragile. I don't know where it's going to take us, but I'm afraid that if things don't change in another few years, we could be back in America to warehousing. It's only a few weeks ago, you know, that in the state of Oklahoma, there was a scandal. There's now a scandal on institutions for the retarded that are right out of Christmas in Purgatory in 1983. And if you go to West Virginia's institutions today, you're going to see Christmas in Purgatory in spades right today. It isn't that all the institutions have been cleared up. And it's only going to be another few years when budgets get tight and we're going to start stuffing them in again that we're going to be back to those kinds of institutions everywhere. Because the citizens don't understand how you could spend $100,000 for institutional care. And as a matter of fact, neither can I. There have to be better ways than that. Now, some of you say, but people have to be in institutions. They must be in institutions. Well, I want to make one remark, and I want to play a 10-minute tape, and maybe you'll have some questions. I want to tell you about the tape. I've got to ask you this question. This is the remark. What goes on in an institution for the mentally retarded that can't go on in the community? And I think if you ponder that question, you're going to realize absolutely nothing. Now, if you ask a question about a hospital, yes, there are things. You need surgery, you need a certain kind of room, you need a sterile environment, then you need a post-op room, and you need certain kinds of specialized equipment. But in an institution for the retarded, there's nothing that goes on there that can't go on in the community. Bed patients? Bed patients are the easiest people to care for in the community or the institution. They don't run around. They're not a locus. The people who are the difficult ones to care for are those who are running around. A couple of years ago, I got a letter and then some telephone calls and then I was sent a tape, long tapes, from a woman named Marion Rose White, whose mother institutionalized her in one of the state hospitals in California many, many years ago. She spent a total of 30, 35 years in that institution. Quite recently, they made a TV movie about her life. She has a very revealing story to tell. I asked her to put on tape a couple of years ago her autobiography, and what I did is I took a segment of it to play for you, pieced together some things, just a few minutes. She sent me long, long tapes, but I just put together a few minutes. So you could get a different kind of perspective about someone who's been in one of these places. Let me play it for you, and maybe then you'll want to ask a few questions.
When I was 9 years old, my mother placed me in Sonoma State Hospital for the mentally retarded.
She's given me permission.
The doctor had told her I was retarded. In those days, you did the work. We were taught to make beds and undress little children, bathe them, and put them to bed. I helped with the children, though I could not bathe them yet, for I was yet too young. We had to get up very early. We got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, got dressed, made our beds, polished the floor, went into the day hall to wait for the technicians to come on at 7. When the technicians arrived at 7 o'clock, we all lined up, marched downstairs to eat our breakfast. In the dining room, you were not allowed to hardly open your mouth or speak a word, though you would get scolded. Every morning, we would have prunes and mush. Prunes and mush was the menu. It is the menu till this day. We would get done breakfast. We'd go upstairs. Us older girls would comb the younger girls' hair and get them ready for school or to go out to play. We would line up two by two and go on a large, big porch. We would march around that porch with our arms folded while technicians stood behind us with a stick. Anyone dare make a move, you would get hit in the leg. Things were rough. I should say they were. I know they would give us cold baths and put pillowcases over our head and duck us into a cold bath of water. For little things, they would punish us that way. That was their way of making us, as you call, good behavior. Some people, they gave dope medicine to for bad behavior. They put me on phenobarb one time, and they had to get me off in a hurry, for I was seeing things that was not in my room or around the ward. One of the technicians named Nell Bryson, I'm not afraid to name her, dead, will not hurt anybody. She used to beat us girls for no reason at all, and